CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
I'm your host, Cam Wells. This first segment of our show is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Kathy Doubledom will be telling us a little bit about her work with Young Life. So what can you tell me about Young Life?
Yeah, so I work for an organization called Young Life, and there's a branch of Young Life called Young Life Capernaum, which focuses on ensuring connection and community and relationship with our teenage friends with disabilities. So Young Life is a faith-based youth mentorship program. And Capernaum is the branch to just make sure we are connecting with our friends with disabilities, ensuring accessibility, both physically and socially, and then also finding leadership opportunities for our friends.
So how do you reach out to those with disabilities who might benefit from the ministry's work?
Sorry, ask that again.
So how do you reach out to folks with disabilities to let them know about the ministry?
Oh, sure. How do we do it? So the way that Young Life works is we partner with parents and schools, try and get connected where teenagers are at. So sometimes schools will allow us to come help coach teams or help add support to different places in the school. Sometimes we just will end up at skateboard parks or hanging out with kids at the mall, whatever it is. And then with Young Life Capernaum, especially in Canada, there's a huge need. A lot of education assistance and different things. There's been cuts to funding. So anywhere we can send our volunteers in to connect with schools and classrooms to just be a support there, we love to do that. And then as we connect with our friends with disabilities, as we get to know them and connect with their families and their parents, we utilize that opportunity just to continue to bring friendship and community into that family.
So, when you mentioned ensuring accessibility, what does that entail? What are some of the key needs?
Yeah, so there's always the physical need. So, in Young Life, we had Young Life for a long time before we started being intentional with disability. So, things like our camps are basic accessibility, but not always completely accessible. So, for instance, we have a lot of gravel at camp. And so our friends in wheelchairs or with mobility issues need help. So we do things like raise money for golf carts or trying to raise money to help pave the camp and different things like that. So to help create the physical or remove physical barriers, as well as in our clubs where kids will attend. So we'll have a club is like a party with a purpose, we call it. It's a gathering that our friends will have together. And we just make sure that there's all sorts of helps needed, like extra support or headphones or ramps that maybe need to be built or whatever it is to make sure the physical accessibility is there. But then we also do relational accessibility. So we make sure we train our staff, we train our volunteer leaders. And we have a group called Campaigners. They're kind of our student leaders. So we make sure to train them as well so that as our friends with disabilities come, they know, you know, how to welcome them, how to make sure that they are included and not just included, but belong and are able to access our program to the fullest extent.
So what are some of the key benefits for your clients with disabilities and being in community and feeling that sense of acceptance.
Yeah. So a lot of the great benefits for us is always relationship. We aren't trained in disability specifically, so we often will have people who are occupational therapists or EAs who want to come and volunteer. But we get our training from the families and from the teens themselves to learn how to care for them properly. But where we are very skilled is in relationship. And so we work really hard to build connection between a volunteer leader and the teen to make sure that that relationship is a great mentorship relationship. But then we also help develop peer-to-peer relationships. So with friends in their school, with friends in their classrooms, and with friends in their programs. So we work really hard to help them receive friendship and be on the receiving end of relationship. But then also, what does it mean to reach out and build friendships and community with those around you as well?
So in your time doing this work and with Young Life, has there been any success moment or story you'd like to share?
Totally. So one of my favorite stories to tell is when we first brought a Young Life Capernaum group to our camp. So we've always had people with disabilities come, but this time we were intentional with support and care around them. And we do an event one night where there's a big, everyone jumps in, it's a big pool party, it's kind of a surprise, so people jump in their clothes at the end of the night, and it can get a little bit crazy just because so many kids jumping in. So we have lots of support and, you know, lifeguards there, but I just knew that for my Capernaum friends, that some of them don't know how to swim, but would want to be a part of this. So we wanted them to put life jackets on just so that they could be a part of it, but also so that they wouldn't drown. And so I appealed to the leaders. We had a leader meeting that morning, and I just asked, you know, the volunteer leaders to say, we are going to have to wear life jackets for our Capernaum friends. So if you would be willing to put life jackets on, or even ask some of your people in your cabins that if they'd be willing to wear life jackets. I know it's not cool as a high school kid to put on a life jacket, but we just didn't want our friends to stand out as the kids with disabilities wearing life jackets. And so I just let them know that. So night of the pool party comes, the you know, we kind of pull the kids aside right before it happens to say to our girls to say, we've got to put these life jackets on. Everyone's going to jump in the pool, and we just need to stay safe. And they were quite frustrated by that because they didn't want to be separated out, which fair enough. But we also knew that most of them didn't know how to swim, and it was not safe for them to go in. And so we're trying to convince them that this was a good idea. And then right when they released all the kids to go, this whole cabin of boys started coming up along the pool, and they were just chanting, life jackets, life jackets. And came right up and put life jackets on. And so to see all these boys wearing life jackets, our girls were more than happy to put on life jackets and jump in. And we just watched. There's probably in the end, 30 to 40 people out of that big group of people in the pool that all had life jackets on because they just understood the value of having not just a couple kids be separated out with the life jackets. But then what happened afterwards was people came up to me and said, I am just so glad. I've always wanted to wear a life jacket. I've never felt safe in that. I've never been able to go in because I also don't know how to swim. And so to be able to put on a life jacket allowed me to be a part of it as well. And so it just was such a beautiful picture of universal design and how our friends needing to wear the life jackets actually helped a lot of other people enjoy that night and have a good night. So now it's tradition. There's quite a few kids that will put them on, and they do it sometimes just to be funny, or sometimes they wear it because they want to, but it's created this new piece of accessibility for everyone who actually feels better to wear a life jacket is able to wear one. So it was this really beautiful picture of how universal design came through our friends.
Light, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. In this segment of our show, Andrea Van Hook will be telling us a little bit about Resna. So what can you tell me about Resna?
So thank you so much for having me on. Resna is the Rehabilitation Engineering and Assistive Technology Society of North America. We are an independent, not-for-profit, professional membership organization for people who work in areas of assistive technology, like seating and mobility, communication devices, computer access, environmental accessibility. Basically, anyone who works with people with disabilities so that they can go to school, work, rest of us.
So, how do you go about reaching out to those who might want to be involved and also those who could benefit from the work you do?
Well, we have a website. We do a lot of promotion of our website and our materials at various conferences throughout the U.S. We offer certification of assistive technology professionals, so we do have a Find an Assistive Technology Professional directory on the homepage of our website that individuals with disabilities can use to search for someone who's certified in their community, so they know that they're getting someone that ResNet has assessed, and they have passed our very rigorous certification exam, so they are qualified to provide services.
So, in terms of assistive technologies, are there any trends or common threads in what people search for? In other words, what are some of the greatest needs out there in terms of adaptation?
Well, one of the greatest needs is actually funding. In the United States, funding of assistive technology is very hodgepodge. Some people have private insurance that is quite good. Others rely on the Medicaid program, their state Medicaid program, and Medicare, and not everything is covered. So some folks have to do GoFundMe or do fundraising efforts to get the technologies that they need. So that's a big issue, and we do try to help with that. There are also Assistive Technology Act programs in most of the states that are set up to try to help people navigate that. It's very confusing. The other thing right now that people are searching for is they want to know how artificial intelligence can help them with their assistive technology. That is brand new. It's only been in the last couple of years that artificial intelligence has really taken off. And we are starting to have some education for our professionals and some at our conference, which is coming up in May, some sessions on using AI with assistive technology and the pros and cons of that.
So in your time with ResNet, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Definitely. I think that I've been with ResNet now for 5 years as executive director, and prior to that I was the membership and marketing manager with ResNet. I think the biggest things that have stood out for me is last year we were successful with a number of our stakeholder partners in getting Medicare to cover seat elevation in wheelchairs. Which is really important, that allows people to elevate their seat so that they can cook safely, for example, talk to their friends at eye level, that kind of thing. And that was a 20-year project to get that passed and covered. Now we're hoping to do the same with standing systems with Medicare. There's also been tremendous advancements in alternative and augmentative communication, which is really fantastic to see, where people can actually communicate with lots of research coming out now with their eye gaze technology, with their muscle movements. And we're even starting to see some brain interface technologies, which is extremely exciting. And I would say that the smartphone revolution has been very exciting because it allows many people to live independently in their home because they can use their phone to turn on their TV, to lock their door, and turn on their lights and do all kinds of stuff.
So, if you could send any message to the community about the importance of your work and why it needs to keep pushing forward, what would you say?
I would say
that we're all part of one big family. And people with disabilities are a part of that family. And we, you know, it enhances everyone's life and everyone's community if people with disabilities are able to participate fully. And that is our goal, so that there is no barrier and everyone can be together.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure. Thanks. Of course, thank you.
My pleasure.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The UWSA Campus Pride Center is coming back bigger than ever. With a newly implemented volunteer committee system, the director of our services is community-orientated and designed to accomplish so much more. Email campuspride@uwindsor.ca for more information.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Kathy Doubledam told us a little bit about Young Life, and we heard an update on Resna from Andrea Van Hook. In this segment of our show, Bill Gaventa will be telling us a little bit about the Disability Ministry Network. So what can you tell me about the Disability Ministry Network and your experiences with it?
Well, the Disability Ministry Network grew out of it's the latest version, and hopefully will be around for a while, of an attempt to build communication and collaboration between Christian organizations that work in the faith and disability arena. And those might include denominational offices in disabilities, parachurch organizations like Johnny and Friends, or other ones, and there are a number of those around the country, and agencies, organizations that run services for people with disabilities, like Eval's agency in Ontario, Kairos, I think is the name, used to be Christian Horizons, but who also work with congregations and faith communities about being welcoming and inclusive. So a few years ago, there used to be a network that was connected through the National Council of Churches, and then later there was another network called the Christian Council for Persons with Disabilities, and both of those kind of faded, and the person who had tried to keep alive the National Council of Churches network talked to me, and we said, what do you think of the chances of trying to kind of revive that? And so we, together, it was a much different landscape with lots more organizations now working in that space. We contacted as many as we could and found out about it and invited people to a dialogue and conversation, which happened over Zoom online for about a year, that led to the formation of the Disability Ministry Network. It started, this is the third year now of its being in existence, third president. So it was the year before those 3 years, that the year and a half, that the dialogue led to the formation of the group and its incorporation and bylaws. And so I was pretty involved from the very beginning and then served as the president for the first year, but no longer am on the board.
So I'm kind of curious, what are some of the common needs among churches trying to support persons with disabilities?
Common needs among churches, I think it really varies from church to church. Sometimes clergy are not sure what to do. Leadership are not sure what to do. Perhaps they've never had any training in it. Sometimes there's fear about doing the wrong thing, fear about maybe things costing too much, which is really not really true at all. And then, of course, like with any other kind, think about any kind of church ministry that's reaching out to a new group of people. The same questions are there. Do we have the people who feel called to do that? How do we organize it? How do we, what kind of funds do we raise for it if needed? And then, of course, this is around not doing something out there, but inviting and helping people to come in and to be a more lively and participating member of the congregation. There may be implications about physical changes that need to happen, like ramps and other kinds of things. But some of the, you know, think about what happens when a church tries to start any kind of new ministry. What are the same kinds of questions?
So, what are some of the benefits for someone with a disability to be able to be included within a church and feel like part of the congregation?
The less things I've learned from people with disabilities over the years and what I've seen is that not feeling included or feeling really ejected or left out sometimes or excluded is a really painful experience, and that being included with other people, not as somebody special, but just being included, is a way of saying and feeling and experiencing, I am one of God's children, I'm part of God's people, my faith is important to me, and it's important to me that I have a place where I can worship, where I can develop a community, where I can also serve, I can learn, I can have fun with other people's, you know, in activities that are fun within congregations. So it's. I think, again, you ask the same question about why would anybody else want to be part of a church? And I think some of those answers are particularly poignant for people with disabilities because too often they are marginalized.
So in your time with the network, has there been any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Well, the network is not a network of individual congregations or clergy or, you know, there's not open to general membership. It's an organization to help build the capacity of the organization, all the organizations involved, so to help each other, learn from each other, collaborate where possible. And after that first year, one of the things the group was able, we kind of took a while to get your feet underneath you and get the processes built. But one of the first things we were able to do was come together and successfully apply for a grant that led to a research project that included about 16 or 17 of the member organizations to go and talk with clergy and worship leaders in congregations that they knew or ones they wanted to make contact about what kinds of multi-sensory worship techniques and strategies they use in their congregations and their worship services, and whether or not the ones they use they had developed because of trying to include people with different kinds of disabilities in there, such as, you know, large print, or maybe there are some, kits that a lot of churches now are developing kind of sensory kits and ways for children who get antsy to have something to do, but to look at the ways in which worship can include involving all of the senses, because that becomes particularly important when somebody's sensual way of participating is impacted by disabilities. So you've got to look at the other ways of communication and how that's good, not only for people with disabilities, but also for the whole congregation. So people went out and talked to clergy and got a huge number of ideas about what things people were already doing. It kind of helped clergy think in new ways about, maybe these are things we're doing and this things we've tried and we'd like to learn more about this. So that research process is we had a meeting back in November that kind of looked through all the the kinds of answers we got and began to formulate and organize that, and that's going to lead to some products for the organizations to use in working with congregations and clergy, and going to lead to some online products that anybody can access. That's one example. A second example is that this year, Disability Ministry Network has started a monthly discussion or not discussion group webinar featuring different people, but led by the new Baylor University Institute on faith and disability, collaborative on faith and disability, and it's going to feature a discussion every month of some new research article or finding or project and what people are learning about faith and disability, what congregations are doing, what works, what doesn't work, what people are learning. So that started off of this year. And also starting off this year are some webinars where different organizations will be sharing some of their skills and expertise that others may want to learn about. So again, it's a way of, I think, helping people learn from each other and feeling like they can do some things together that they couldn't do by themselves.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. My friends, the whole idea of disability ministries should be aimed centrally, one idea, I think, lifting up people with disabilities in the congregation, moving away from the ideas of pity or that this is someone who automatically needs or wants healing. The fact of the matter is, you can't make that assumption. You can't just figure someone with a disability has nothing to contribute, and we should go out of our way to sugarcoat the things we say and do around them. The fact is, that leaves a lasting impression. Leaves a person with a disability with the idea they can only go so far, even in the eyes of a spiritual organization. One centered at being inclusive and welcoming people. If it's done in a dismissive or second-class citizen sort of way, it's not worth doing. But for a person with a disability who finds true inclusion, true respect within the walls of a church, a mosque, a synagogue, what have you, that can change everything for them. Finding one's purpose in life, one's value within a community, which is what a congregation is designed to be, can change one's perception from the idea of the world as a hopeless place to one where they feel they can be included and belong. But it can't come from others going out of their way to sugarcoat the realities around them or take it upon themselves to assume what a person with a disability wants or needs. Community is just that, the idea of working together, sharing resources, sharing ideas. Now, for people with disabilities to come together and to share their own vision of greater things is not wrong. It is, however, something to be led by people with disabilities. No one knows their own hearts and minds better than those affected. And truly, I've seen what can happen when someone takes it upon themselves to, without consent or without forethought, assume that healing is needed or wanted. There are people with disabilities who are very functional, contributory members of society. Could it be that they have learned to work with their skills to the best of their abilities? Could it be that they're even happy in their lives? And could it be that taking it upon oneself to try to correct a fundamental part of what a person is just not the right approach? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.